Hello out there and welcome to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob Schenck.
And I'm Will Smith.
And we are trial attorneys focusing in the areas of nursing home abuse and neglect in the state of Georgia. Happy Memorial Day, everybody.
Happy Memorial Day.
Will, as a Marine, what is the difference between Veterans Day and Memorial Day?
Veterans Day is when we honor anyone who has served. And then Memorial Day is when we remember those who have died in service of their country.
That's right. I think that's a difference that most people don't realize.
Right. Like, you wouldn't tell somebody happy Memorial Day, you know, thank you for your service, because they're alive. You're talking to them.
Correct.
Yeah.
Of lesser importance, with the exception of my stomach, what is June 1st?
June 1st.
Which is Friday.
June is a very special month because it is my birthday, and it is also the birthday month of my brother's first child, Emma. She hasn't come just yet.
As we record this,
but she is due some point in June. We're hoping that she can stay inside until June 12th.
Memorial Day important, the birth of your niece not quite as important as June 1st, as I was mentioning, Friday, which is National Donut Day. National Donut Day.
What's June 6th?
Okay, June 6th is... Oof, you got me on that.
You know, it's close to June 1st, because they're both D-Days.
Oh, June 6th is the... It will be the... 70th anniversary of the invasion of the of Normandy, mm-hmm. of the Allied invasion of Normandy.
Yeah.
What was that movie? Oh, it wasn't D-Day. It was Dunkirk.
Dunkirk was different. Yeah, yeah.
And then Darkest Hour also has a little bit to do with that.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right.
Where Gary Oldman plays Winston Churchill.
Correct. It's pretty wild, because the movie is just a philosophical look at whether or not Britain should have capitulated or negotiated peace terms versus fight to the last man. Anyway, we keep getting off the topic, which is Donut Day. And I have the Krispy Kreme app, and I'm ready. I'm lock, stock, and barrel, ready to go and get my however many free they give me for National Donut Day, which I think one is free.
I thought this was a joke.
It's National Donut Day, June 1st.
I did not know that.
So be ready this year, because those are the type of things that sneak up on you, like National Taco Day, and Taco Bell's giving away one free taco. National Donut Day, June 1st, this Friday, you're probably going to get a free donut everywhere they have donuts. Be ready. All right. And speaking of donuts.
Well, not a huge fan of that segue, because I don't really know how this is speaking of donuts, other than the last time that we had him on here, he confided to us later that he had accidentally eaten too many Cadbury eggs that day. So I can only imagine that on National Donut Day, he might make a fool of himself. But we have back on here my brother, Clay Smith, the RN.
Welcome back, Clay.
Hey, everyone, and National Donut Day. You know, isn't that great?
Yeah, but I do want to talk about what you told us after the podcast last time you were on, is that you thought that you may have eaten too many Cadbury eggs.
Right.
How many did you eat?
What I've learned is that with Cadbury eggs, I mean, you're really playing kind of Russian roulette here, you know.
Well,
I mean, is one too many? Is six too many? I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
Nobody's a scientist here. Right. Well, just real quickly, though, Will, I mean, you and I know that he's your brother, but what does the audience need to know about Clay's background?
So, Clay is a registered nurse. He practices in a PCU, which is a progressive care unit up in North Georgia. He has worked in ICUs, which are just above progressive care units, which have more intensive care, and he's worked in med-surg units, which are below PCUs. He's also been a former Army, thinking about Cadbury eggs again, a former Army medic. He was an EMT, And he has also worked in nursing homes for a really long time. He's been in the healthcare now industry for about 10 years. We even work together in nursing homes in Georgia. Welcome aboard, Clay.
Yay. So,
hey, everyone.
Clay, this episode, we want to get into the nuts and bolts of
bed sores,
yeah. Pressure ulcers, your interactions with them, specifically getting into who's at risk for them, and in terms of if a listener or audience member has a loved one that's going into a skilled nursing facility, what should they be concerned about with regard to preventing pressure ulcers and bed sores?
You should know that if your loved one is not mobile, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not getting up on their own. If they're in bed or in a chair or any sort of sitting position where they're immobile for any length of time, it doesn't have to be all day, but for hours on end, they're at risk of getting a bed sore or a pressure ulcer. There's a scale that a lot of hospitals like to use. It's called the Braden scale. This first came out in the early 80s, but it essentially looks at a patient's risk for getting a pressure ulcer. They use this scale in nursing homes too, but in hospitals, it's standard that every single patient, it doesn't matter how young, how old, how mobile they are, they have to have a Braden scale assessment placed on them, because pressure ulcers are potentially very dangerous.
Well, now, why would it be that, and you may not know the answer to this, why I would have imagined that in a nursing home, you must have the Braden scale assessment rather than you must have it in a hospital?
Well, it's part of the thing is it really kind of depends on what kind of nursing home or what kind of hospital you go into. This may be going too in depth, but typically most hospitals in the United States are actually nonprofit. So because of that, they have to have some sort of accrediting agency that they use, either JCO or whatever, because they use Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Because of that, they have a lot of protocols and a lot of things in place to prevent things from happening. Pressure ulcers, as far as the federal government is concerned, is 100% preventable. Yeah. Now, whether that's actually true, medically speaking, is kind of irrelevant, but hospitals are going to do whatever they can to make sure that they do not get a pressure ulcer. Because if they do, they are not reimbursed for the care of that. And pressure ulcers, depending on how severe they are and other comorbidities that a patient might have, they can take weeks, months to years. I mean, they may never be completely healed. They're very, very expensive, very time-consuming, and potentially very deadly.
I got you. Well, that's actually interesting, because I don't think we'd ever encountered because it's counterintuitive that these hospitals would have it more of a requirement than a nursing home, because you would imagine that nursing home residents are typically more at risk. But the reason is that they want that accreditation from the Joint Commission or whomever it may be, and so they've got these policies in place. It sounds like something nursing homes should do. They don't do it, of course, but they should do it.
Right, and a lot of this really depends on the kind of nursing home. A lot of nursing homes are private care. This would be something else I would want to investigate if I was looking at a nursing home to send my loved one. So private care facilities, while not always the case, kind of notoriously have worse care. Because their bottom line is always going to have to be profit, they're going to try to skimp on as much care as they possibly can. That includes staffing, that includes, you know, the proper care and all these things that are in place that nonprofit facilities don't really have those issues, you know.
Well, what is the difference between nonprofit and private?
So back in the, I want to say in the 60s, most hospitals in the United States were actually profit-based, right? So that means that you could treat them like a company. They could have shareholders. They had a profit margin that they were trying to reach. With the advent of Medicare and Medicaid, that kind of changed everything. So with hospitals, one of the most important things you have to remember with a profit-based margin is that they can actually decline care to patients. Now, We don't usually experience this because most hospitals in the United States are on a nonprofit model. So they can't deny care to individuals no matter what it is. So, for example, if you come into the ER and you are having a heart attack, they don't stop you and say, well, you know, what kind of insurance do you have? They have to treat you right away. Mm-hmm. So that's with a nonprofit hospital, they have to treat you. Now, the plus side to a nonprofit is they're not paying taxes, right? Mm-hmm. So they, for example, their employees may have what's called a 403B instead of a 401K. You know, most things are deducted. Their bottom line isn't profit. They're going to treat whoever they have to no matter what. So with a profit-based model, that's obviously different. So
yeah.
I think the largest for-profit hospitals I could think of would be like Kaiser hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, that's interesting. Now, I took us off topic there just for a second. But the Braden scale, so we've learned that it's an assessment done in most hospitals and nursing homes. Can you describe what the Braden scale is, what the assessment looks at?
Sure. So a Braden scale is every single patient has a physical assessment that's done throughout the day by every nurse. And one of the assessments is looking at the Braden scale. And this pretty much just looks at how much of a risk a person is in getting a pressure ulcer. Mm-hmm. It's a scale that goes from 0 to 23, 23 being no risk. Anything less than 6 means that they're going to be at an extreme high risk of getting a pressure ulcer. So okay. The things they look at the most would be things like sensory perception. So does the patient have an ultra level of consciousness? Or are they able to even tell you if they're in pain? Is there activity, or are they immobile? Are they able to get up on their own? Do they have proper nutrition? Do they have increased moisture in certain areas?
Okay,
like,
so
are they incontinent? Are they sweating too much?
Right,
so it looks at all these things. It creates a score, and based off that score, they look at, well, what's the risk of this person getting a pressure ulcer?
So let me jump in there really quickly, Clay, in terms of the symptoms or the characteristics that you just named off. So, for example, tell me why the mental cognitive impairments, if any, are important in your assessment. Why is that important?
So if you think about if a person's in pain, you know, so typically if you're in pain, you're going to say something, right? You have very simple signs. You're going to cry out, or you're just going to ask somebody, hey, I'm in pain. Something's wrong. But one of the first signs of developing a pressure ulcer is pain. You know, you have increased redness on the skin. It's irritating. It hurts. So that's a problem. If someone has an altered mental status, if they're unconscious, they're not able to tell you anything. You know,
I see.
Their dementia may be so severe that they're constantly screaming out. You don't really know if it's because of pain or if that's just their natural state at this moment.
What about incontinence? What importance does incontinence, and I guess from a broader standpoint, moisture play?
So incontinence is huge, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that the main area where people get pressure ulcers the most are on bony prominences of the body. So that's on your sacrum or your coccyx, which is your tailbone, and on your heels, and sometimes on your cranium, in the back of your head. And that's because these bony prominences, they with added pressure when you're not mobile, can decrease capillary refill and makes it difficult for blood flow to go through. So these bony prominences are very common to where you're going to get these pressure ulcers. Now in your sacrum, when you're immobile and you're urinating on yourself, or if you have lots of feces, this can cause more skin irritation and can cause skin breakdown.
What skin breakdown? What is? I mean, it sounds like you would be able to figure it out, but actually describe skin breakdown.
So anytime that, like, especially with urine, it's very acidic, and so is your stool. It's not made to be on your skin for any period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who is incontinent and is constantly urinating on themselves or constantly having feces on themselves, and it's sitting on their skin for a long time, will start to develop redness. And that affects the integrity of the skin itself. Mm-hmm. You can start getting sores. You can start getting breakdowns. And if you're already developing a pressure ulcer, it can exacerbate that.
And I just wanted to highlight, you'd mentioned about the fact that particularly where there are bony prominences, the likelihood of bed sores increases because of the impact that the bone and the surface has on the capillaries. But the real reason within that is because without full blood flow, when there's blood flow is restricted or completely eliminated, that's the blood functions as the deliverer of oxygen to the tissue and to the skin. And so when there's no blood flow, there's no oxygen, there's no nutrients. There is no nutrients to it. And that's what's
And there's more things you have to consider than just that. I mean, that's the beauty of the Braden scale. You have to also consider things like nutrition. So, for example, people with diabetes already have impaired wound healing because when you have elevated sugar in your blood all the time, you don't heal as well. People who are not eating as well and they don't have adequate protein intake, protein is essential for wound healing as well.
Why is protein important?
Protein is one of the macronutrients that you use for just rebuilding tissue. Okay. So if you notice bodybuilders eat tons and tons and tons of protein, the reason why they're doing that is because they're constantly destroying muscle fiber and rebuilding it up.
Mm-hmm. And so that's because they're, and I'm just putting the dots together here, because they have that huge wound on them, they want it to cover up. They want it to grow back together. Yeah. Okay.
I'll say real quick, because this is a question I get a lot in the hospital, and I've really had just in anywhere, is how quickly can someone get a pressure ulcer? This mm-hmm. is actually a very hard thing to answer, and if you actually try to find research on it, it's hard because it really depends on a whole number of different things. But essentially, if someone is immobile, completely immobile, for even a few hours, they can develop a stage one pressure ulcer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, at least in our experience with our clients, we've had, I mean, it can be over the course of a shift.
Absolutely.
You know, after a surgery or if for some reason somebody's immobile, particularly with the symptoms that you've listed, including some of our clients are morbidly obese. Mm-hmm. And that adds, obviously, to the likelihood.
Of course, we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about a stage four in a matter of
You know, we're talking about a stage one on its way to getting worse because of all the factors that are there.
And actually, I don't know that he covered the different stages. Are you?
Well, let's do this. Let's come to the stages, but I want to actually keep knocking off the list. Okay. on the Braden scale, and then Clay, if you don't mind, tell me about the numbering system within that. So we've talked about the mental capacity. Mm-hmm. We've talked about incontinence, moisture. We've talked about blood. Actually, we didn't finish with the blood. So we talked about protein is important, mm-hmm. and the blood sugar. Can you tell us more about how blood sugar affects the wound repair with someone with bed sore?
Yeah, so this is actually something that doctors have noticed for a long time, which is that patients with uncontrolled diabetes and high blood sugar typically have poor blood flow to certain areas. And it's not just with diabetes. It's also people with vascular disease or heart failure. Anytime where you're having impairment of blood reaching certain tissues and then returning with that waste product, not getting oxygen to these areas, you're going to have impaired wound healing. So when you start to develop a wound, if someone has heart failure or heart disease and they're diabetic, they're at an extreme risk for having issues with necrosis or trying to heal these wounds. This is one of the reasons why you notice a lot of diabetic patients may be missing limbs, because they start to have really bad blood flow, and over time, this tissue becomes to the point where it's not salvageable.
Okay, so you're conducting your assessment of your patient, of the resident, Clay, mm-hmm. and you're clicking all these, you're checking all these boxes. What's the calculation like? What is it? What does the document look like that you're using? What do the numbers mean? And literally, you know, is it 1 to 6 in terms of each individual characteristics? Walk us through that.
Sure. So if I have a patient and I'm going through the Braden scale, so there's the main assessments I'm looking at are sensory perception, moisture, activity, mobility, nutrition, and something called friction and shear. Now, this is something we didn't cover, but this is also something that's very important. A patient who is immobile and is constantly sliding back and forth on the bed can have this what they call like a friction experience on the skin. And this increases the risk of someone developing one of these sores. So somebody who's constantly having to be readjusted in the bed, or they're constantly falling down the bed and staff are having to pick them back up in the bed, this can make issues even worse. Now, there are certain beds you can use to help prevent this from exacerbating, but nonetheless, this is a scale that we look at. And to answer your question, as far as the numbers itself, so we go from 0 yeah. to 23. Each one of these categories has a number, usually from 0 to 6, and we'll place a number like, for example, sensory perception. Are they fully awake and alert and with it, or are they just completely unconscious, right? So I can give either a 0 or a 6. By the end of this, I'm going to look at my score. So if they're 23, if they're 20, if they're 19, that means that they're at a very low risk of developing a pressure ulcer. But anytime someone is less than 15, they're at what's called a moderate to severe risk of getting a pressure ulcer.
Okay, but here's the question that I have is why do you give somebody a 5 versus a 4 or a 3 versus a 4
in each of the individual categories?
Yeah,
what
is this like a sure. is so this
the,
like a
that number is not arbitrary. It will say something like, so for moisture, it could say something like, is it very moist? So is every single time you come in to do an assessment, you notice that they have incontinent episodes, you notice that they're always very moist. Mm-hmm. Is it rarely moist? So there is a little bit of
wiggle room,
kind of guessing on here.
Yeah.
But the point is that the scale is wide enough that it's not like if someone is a 16 instead of a 15, then it's like, oh, well, then they're at a low risk. We're not going to worry about it.
I got you.
So a drop from a 16 to 15 is pretty significant.
So okay. it sounds like, though, that it's like what the Likert scale, where it's like, how likely are you to visit Blockbuster again? You know, 1 is not very likely, 6 sure. is extremely likely.
Still a nursing assessment. Like, if a nurse is not doing a good assessment, they could put a higher score than they should be putting.
Yeah.
So that's a good segue, Clay. So you've assessed the resident. You've assigned a number. In this instance, Clay, let's go with the most amount of risk. So they're in the, mm-hmm. 13, 14, 15 range, okay? They're in more right. they're moderate to more of a risk. So what do you do with that knowledge? What is the actions that you take once you've made that assessment to prevent
the bed sores? So hospitals actually have something very interesting in play. Most hospitals now use electronic documentation, and there's been more of a push to send out these automatic alerts when patients have certain types of criteria. So sepsis is one thing that we look at, and that's obviously something we could talk about on another day. But for the brain scale in particular, if I'm making an assessment on a patient, and let's say I get a brain score of 10, that's going to automatically send out an alert to that patient and to everyone who has access to that patient's medical record. Listen, this person has a low brain score. We need to do we need to start implementing a plan of care to prevent them from getting a pressure ulcer. So one of the first things that it does is it alerts the staff, it alerts the MD, and we can consult a wound care specialist. Then somebody will come out and then start making assessments and make recommendations of what we can do to prevent them from getting more of a pressure ulcer. So is the incontinence so severe, for example, that we need to put in a Foley catheter, or we need to have a rectal tube in place, for example? Do we need to put them on a very strict turning schedule, or do we need to put barrier creams or certain types of equipment or padding or change the bed itself to prevent them from having this in place?
What's so barrier cream? Barrier cream? Did you say barrier cream?
Barrier cream, yes.
What's barrier cream?
Barrier cream is essentially, they come in different varieties, but essentially when someone is incontinent and you place this barrier cream on them, it prevents the urine or feces from actually touching the skin itself.
Mm-hmm. So Clay, you've assessed the resident, you've assessed them as a moderate to high risk. You sent out the red alert. You've done these preventative measures. let's say that the wound gets worse. Can you walk us through the stages of a bed sore? What are the stages of a bed sore? Walk us through what the prevention methods at each of the different levels of the bed sore. What would you do at each level?
Sure. So the first stage, stage one, this is when you have intact skin, but it's non-blanchable, okay? So what I mean by that is this. If you were to take your arm and press your finger down onto your skin and let go, you notice that the skin would probably turn white and red and then would go back into being your normal skin color. So that's what's called a blanchable skin.
Okay.
Okay. So if you notice a red spot on, let's say, your sacrum, the first thing you do is put some gloves on, press down on it, and if you notice it's still red, it's not blanchable, that's a sign that they may be developing a stage one.
Ah. So it's internal. It's inside them at first.
That's correct. So with a stage one, it's very localized. It's generally not very deep. If mm-hmm. you're on the epidermis, you're not really into the dermis itself. And also, too, depending on the skin color of the patient, it can be kind of difficult to assess a stage one. But a stage one should be a high alert. It does not mean that if I see a stage one, we're like, oh, we're not worried about it. Stage one is the most concerning that we should be, because you really want to prevent any sort of bed sore from happening. So stage gotcha. One is when you really pull out all the stops to try to do everything you can to prevent this from progressing any further. And stage one can actually recover usually within a couple of days.
And let's say that they haven't done that. Then you're at a stage two. What's a stage two?
So stage two is when you actually have partial thickness loss of the dermis itself. Okay.
What does that
this
mean?
This is when it no longer looks red. It's going to start looking kind of pink. It hasn't gone down to the point of where it's actually below the dermis itself or the skin layer, and you're getting to the muscle or fatty tissue. Stage two is also you can have what's called like sloughing of the tissue mm-hmm. itself. You can have this.
So it looks like a wound at this point.
Yeah, exactly. It looks like a wound. And again, this can be tricky to heal. Typically, it can take a week or so, maybe a little bit longer. But that's what a stage two looks like.
But at this point, you've got an open, wound. People would say open wound. Yeah.
Exactly. It's an open wound. It is definitely a site of infection. It would be something that you would need to be very diligent to prevent it from getting any worse.
What are they doing at this stage to try to make it stop getting bigger?
So you try to find what's causing the pressure ulcer. Are they just not getting turned enough? Do they need to increase their mobility? All these things would need to be in place. As far as the wound itself, a lot of times in the hospital we use what's called a Mepilex. It looks like a giant Band-Aid with a cotton on it, and this helps prevent the friction issue that you might have when we're talking about the Braden scale. Mm-hmm. So when people are getting pulled back and forth in the bed, they're not rubbing on that sore, making it worse.
Okay. So let's say that they still haven't stopped this yet, and it goes up to stage three. What are we looking at now?
Okay, so stage three is when it gets very serious, right? Stage three is when you have full thickness tissue loss. You may even have subcutaneous fat tissue that's being exposed. But you're not going to see bone, you're not going to see tendon, you're not going to see muscle or anything like that. Stage three looks like a pretty bad wound. It would be very, very noticeable. Stage three, depending upon other types of comorbidities that patient might have, can take anywhere between a couple weeks to even months to heal.
And what's the main avenue of treatment at this point?
No, we'll say that, for example, it's a sacrum.
Yeah, it's a sacrum.
Ulcer.
Well, the best thing you can do is to relieve the pressure. They need to be off of that wound as much as they possibly can. This is going to require a very diligent turning schedule. This is going to require either placing some sorts of equipment, like creams, bandages, anything that you can possibly on it. By this point, a wound care nurse or a skin specialist is now going to be consulted, and that patient's going to be seen very regularly. Okay, that wound's going to constantly be covered, and you're going to have to do everything you can to keep it nice and clean.
So, let's say that again, they haven't prevented it from getting bigger. We're at a stage four. What is a stage four like?
Stage four would be the worst. Okay. Stage four is very dangerous, very severe. And at this point, it's possible that they may never actually heal this wound. That's when you have full thickness tissue loss. You may even see bone tissue. Mm-hmm. You can also develop something that's called tunneling. So mm-hmm. tunneling is when, just due to the reality of how tissue damage looks, there might be swelling on top, but that the wound itself actually extends deeper down into the tissues of that person. Clay, stage four is very, very, very dangerous.
Do you ever see a misdiagnosis between stage three and stage four? Like, is it sometimes difficult? Because obviously there's not a bright line, you know, or bright line scale. You have to eyeball it sometimes, but... Right. You know, like, because in our experience, some things are charted as stage three when really they're stage four mm-hmm. by most definitions.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say that the stage two and stage three are probably the ones that people mix up the most, right? Because it's still red, and there's kind of confusion upon how deep is it actually going. Mm-hmm. Stage four, you would know. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to misdiagnose a stage four.
You think that's because of the tunneling issue?
Yeah, it's very deep. Yeah. There's going to probably be a smell. You may even notice a smell when you walk into the room.
Yeah, yeah. You will always remember that smell, too.
Yeah.
I have always thought of it as stage one is, it's just a red mark. It's easy to figure out what a stage one, if it's non-blanchable, stage one. But then stage two and three look like, I'm just imagining, for me, like you fell off your bike and scraped your skin. Stage two, it hurts. You scraped your skin. Stage three, it's like, you really scraped your skin. And then stage four, it looks like somebody drilled a hole in you.
That's correct. Yeah, stage four looks like someone took a chunk of tissue out of your body.
Yeah, like it's not mistakeable.
And Clay, what does the term unstageable mean?
Now, unstageable is when either there's full thickness tissue that's so severe, it's just hard to really determine what stage it is, or if either just due to the anatomy of the person or the location of the ulcer, they can't really give an accurate stage. Hmm. I like to think that sometimes it's kind of a cop-out what some people will use for unstageable. Mm-hmm. It's a stage four, but they're not comfortable placing it a stage four. Unstageable just means that it's too difficult for us to determine what this is, or they have they may have a lot of necrotic tissue, so it's just impossible for them to really know. Unstageable is also not very good. This would be a very bad thing to have.
Gotcha. Well, Clay, this has been very informative. A lot of good information. We really appreciate it. I mean, you've got a lot of experience with this, and it really comes through with the knowledge you brought today.
Yeah,
yeah. And I just want to say, pressure ulcers, they are preventable. Mm-hmm. And no matter what people say to you, like you may have a loved one who is very sick and very immobile. Perhaps they're overweight. You know, perhaps they have all these other things in place. And you might have staff say this, because I've heard staff and I've heard doctors say this before, well, unfortunately, this is preventable. That's not true. You can prevent these from happening. It may require a lot of work and a lot of diligence, but just because the right thing is hard to do doesn't mean it shouldn't be done.
Amen, brother.
Aw. Yeah.
Well, Clay, we had on my brother. We talked about bed sores, and we even mentioned Blockbuster. But we really nobody likes my alliteration. I've been thinking about it for a while.
Wow, I went over my head.
Oh, okay. Anyway, we really appreciate you coming on. We'll have to have you on again. You know, whenever your life slows down from taking care of baby Emma. Whenever that may be, in a couple months. But love you, buddy, and glad you came on.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Anytime.
All right. All right.
Well, I will say this. We should have Clay is your younger brother, okay? But he's a twin.
Yes, I have two younger brothers.
Okay, so we need to have the other brother on. It's an all-brothers episode.
Yeah, Jake never worked in a nursing home. I cannot imagine him doing that. So, I can't.
We can have an English teaching English as a second language.
Yeah, he teaches English in Korea.
In Korea.
He could probably talk about how Korea doesn't really have a nursing home epidemic like we do. Just like our new intern was telling us that they don't have that big of an issue in South Africa either. Because people in other countries respect their elderly.
More so than here.
Yeah, more so than here.
Well, I guess that does it for this episode, number 70. Again, happy Memorial Day. Hope everybody takes a few moments to remember the sacrifices of those in the armed forces. And National Donut Day.
National Donut Day.
National Donut
Day. I'm looking forward to it now.
Krispy Kreme glazed donut, hot. Just down the road. Anyway, all right, guys. Until next time. Wait, no, not until next time. We'll see you. Wait. Hang on. How can we consume each and every episode? We always have to do this. This is like the...
Oh, well, you can go to our website, shinksmith.com, or
nursinghomeabusepodcast.com,
or anywhere that you can download MP3 or audio, if people still download MP3. I don't think that
they can. You can go to Pod Puppies.
You can go to Stitcher. You can go to Spotify. You can find it on YouTube.
Podcast Bandits.
Yep.
Anywhere where you get podcasts.
Anywhere you get podcasts. You wouldn't go anywhere to download MP3 now, would you?
So maybe on Napster you can still find our episodes.
Yeah.
But anyway, with that, we will see you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and feel free to leave us some feedback. And for more information about the topics discussed in this episode, check out the show website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. That's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.